The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Happy New Year, everyone. We are off to a great start. Nathaniel Hawthorne. We're going to look at his life and works today and focus on the Scarlet Letter in our next episode. And we are having some new beginnings, a fresh new start. Hard to believe that's possible after almost 300 episodes of the History of Literature, but hey, why not? Who says we can't? So we're going to have a tweet of the week, which will set up some of our themes today. And then I'm going to count down 10 things to know about Nathaniel Hawthorne. Maybe not a countdown, but I've listed 10 things. He's a hugely famous American writer, but maybe not well loved. More respected than loved, we might say. Kind of like a Henry James, who of course admired Hawthorne. Maybe that's why he admired Hawthorne. Who are beloved authors? Jane Austen comes to mind, and the Brontes, and Charles Dickens, and J.D. Salinger, E.B. White, J.K. Rowling was, maybe still is, setting aside current political controversies. She was beloved. Even a Thomas Hardy might qualify. Thoreau was beloved by many, and Cormac McCarthy, Arthur Conan Doyle, I would say, is beloved, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Agatha Christie, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Joyce, Kafka. But Hawthorne's as famous as most of those names, but I'm not sure I'd say he appeals to people in the same way, more of a fierce way. He can be very engaging, but he can also be difficult, seeming prickly, kind of doggedly telling you what he wants to tell you no matter what you think. You could be bored, but he doesn't really care. He'll just keep going. Do you know people like that? No, this is my story. Don't interrupt. Oh, half of you fell asleep? Fine with me. Oh, there's nobody left in the room? You've all gone? Doesn't matter to me. This is the story I'm telling. Be here or not. We'll get into all of this in a little bit. So let's start with number one of the things to know. Hawthorne was born in 1804, which places him squarely in the first half of the 19th century. Measured by human presence, America was both old and young. Indigenous peoples had been living in America for thousands of years. And by the start of the 17th century, when the European settlers started arriving in New England, an estimated 70 to 100,000 Indigenous people lived in that area. Algonquins, mostly, with subgroups. They lived in small villages where they grew corn and beans and squash, and the men hunted and fished, and they were there to trade with the Europeans when the Europeans arrived on the ships. The Indigenous people swapped beaver pelts for metals and textiles, and they were also vulnerable to European diseases, which killed many of them. In 1616, an epidemic wiped out perhaps 75% of those living on the Atlantic coast of New England, the indigenous people. In 1620, the Mayflower arrived with the Pilgrims, and they settled in a clearing that many historians believe had been a Pawtuxet village wiped out by disease. The Pilgrims were a group of Puritans who had advocated for a break from the Church of England, which led to them leaving England a few years after 1605. They headed to Holland first. We will have more to say about the Puritans, who were in Massachusetts, when we get to the Scarlet Letter. But you should remember that Hawthorne, writing a couple of hundred years after this period, was fascinated by it all of his life. His ancestor, William Hawthorne, or Hawthorne, came to Salem, Massachusetts, where Hawthorne himself grew up. In 1630 was when William arrived, 10 years after the Mayflower Pilgrims. Nathaniel Hawthorne added the W himself, probably to distinguish himself a bit from the Hawthorne ancestry, H-A-T-H, O-R-N-E was how they spelled it originally. William Hawthorne was a merchant and a magistrate and a captain in the military. And he was a religious zealot who showed no tolerance for other forms of religion or other Christian sects even. He had Quakers whipped in the streets. His son John Hawthorne, or Hawthorne, was a famous judge who became famous or infamous for his prosecution of suspected witches. They called John Hawthorne the hanging judge for the number of witches he sent to the gallows. But let's stick with Hawthorne, Nathaniel Hawthorne, our Hawthorne for now. I said that in 1804, America was both old and new, old and young, because although the indigenous people had been there for thousands of years, and European settlers had been there for close to 200, the United States was barely getting started. In the year Hawthorne was born, 1804, Thomas Jefferson was serving as the country's third president. The country was growing rapidly. There were about 6 million non-native people spread among the 17 states. And by the time Hawthorne wrote the Scarlet Letter, that number had grown to 23 million. For a young American who hoped to be a writer, this meant some possibilities. There were more publications, more potential subscribers for books, and Hawthorne could aspire to be a professional writer. Who were his models? In America, his predecessors were Washington Irving and James Fenimore Cooper, and Edgar Allan Poe was a little bit ahead of Hawthorne. They were near contemporaries. And if you like Poe, but if you wish he were a little more grown up at times, might I recommend to you our subject today, Nathaniel Hawthorne, because that is what he basically is. He's Poe with a little more maturity. Looking to Europe, which was far more dominant culturally than American literature was at the time, we see authors like the Romantic poets, Wordsworth and Coleridge and Blake, when Hawthorne was young, and the younger Romantics like Keats and Byron and Shelley. As Hawthorne was coming of age, we see novelists like Jane Austen and Balzac and Stendhal and Victor Hugo. We see Gogol and Dickens and Dumas. We see the Brontes. We see Mary Shelley. We see Sir Walter Scott. We see George Sand, who was born just 3 days before Hawthorne, coincidentally. And in another coincidence, Hawthorne was born on July 4th, or Independence Day. Very suitable for this intensely American writer, as Henry James noted in his book on Hawthorne. But back to our list. We see Walter Scott. Did I say that already? Hold that thought for a few moments because it'll be important later. All these writers I just mentioned came before The Scarlet Letter and Moby Dick. Hawthorne got kind of a late start, so even the authors who are around his age tended to publish before him. Scarlet Letter and Moby Dick, which were published in 1850 and 1851. This is what was in the air. And for Hawthorne in particular, we can say he came straight out of Romanticism in that movement. And we can go even further and say that it was a strain of dark Romanticism, which puts him in the company of Edgar Allan Poe and Gothic novels and E.T.A. Hoffmann and the stormier works of Lord Byron and Coleridge and John Polidori and Mary Shelley. And in France, we went on with Baudelaire and Verlaine and Rimbaud. They grew out of this dark romanticism movement. What was dark romanticism? In Europe, we see social outcasts, tormented heroes and anti-heroes, the demonic, sexual perversion, the uncanny, alienation. In America, the contrast between transcendentalists is instructive. Hawthorne was friends or acquaintances with most of these guys, Emerson and Thoreau and that crew. They were trying to uplift. They were looking to make the human being perfect, to transcend. Dark romantics, on the other hand, dealt in sin and guilt and self-destruction, accusers and the accused, morality gone wrong, twisted souls, despair. So, we've situated Hawthorne in time and in literary time. Let's look at his childhood and his geography. He was born in Salem, where his ancestors had lived since the 17th century. His family and other families had made their money from the shipping trade, as most Salem families did. Salem had had a stretch where it was one of the most important colonial ports. Salem is about 20 miles north of Boston, and for a while it was the sixth biggest city in the United States. As a port, it was famous around the world, known for its trade with China and Sumatra and Japan and Australia. Of course, it also traded with Europe and the West Indies. Eventually, the harbor silted up, which sent the larger commercial vessels to Boston and New York. They couldn't dock in Salem anymore. And so, Hawthorne was living through a period of inherited wealth with some august families, but also he was in a city that was in something of a decline. And today, Salem is almost entirely unknown as a port city. It's known for the witches, for the Salem witch trials, which were also famous in Hawthorne's day as well. Hawthorne's father was a ship captain who died at sea when Nathaniel was only 4. Nathaniel barely knew his father, who'd been gone for most of his childhood, even before he went missing. His mother moved in with her brother, the Mannings. The uncles, Hawthorne's uncles, were the Mannings, another famous family. Hawthorne grew up there and at their summer home in Maine, which is also where he went to college at Bowdoin. Although he was from a well-pedigreed family and grew up in some affluence, he felt like he was an outsider with the Mannings. Although they kind of left him alone, he always felt like they were intruding on his core family of his mother and his siblings. And he was not a particularly successful young person, even though he went to college. And he spent 12 years trying to become a writer, living at home. We're up to our number 3 thing now, which is to run through Hawthorne's early works and the various jobs that he held during those apprentice years. The Scarlet Letter, his masterpiece, was published when he was in his mid-40s. So we have some distance to get from college to there. We will have that story and a letter from a listener after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Dear Jack, the year ended with a great History of Literature episode. I listened to it on my way to a new dentist, walking through the streets of Braga, Portugal. I was quite apprehensive, as I have a recurrent nightmare of going through a nasty root canal procedure, which is weird because I have never had one, and your storytelling always seems to calm me down. As it turns out, there was nothing to it. My teeth were perfectly fine. Thank you for the company, though. I am looking forward to the episode with Mike. I wish all the best to you and your family in 2021. Kind regards, Italo. Well, Italo, thank you and all the best in return, which goes for all my listeners. Good luck for a healthy and happy 2021. Now, your email was flattering, but it did remind me of the first slogan we tried out here in our early days. The History of Literature podcast, better than a root canal. I thought that had some promise. But our board of directors overruled me when we got our first review from a well-known national magazine, which simply said, debatable. Oh, well, those one-word reviews can be devastating. Perhaps marketing is not my thing. Italo, thank you very much for the email. And to all of you listeners out there who are wondering how to chime in, you can send me an email or you can send me an audio clip, which we're gathering to use in our 300th episode, although we're running out of time. So hurry up and get those audio clips in. We'll see how that goes. Maybe we'll have to scrap the idea. Just record something on your phone. Say hello to the world. Tell us your favorite poem. Read us an inspiring quote. Share whatever you want to share. Ask a question. Answer a question that nobody asked. Whatever compels you the most. Get a snippet of your voice recorded and send it to jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. That's J-A-C-K-E. And we will do the rest. Back to Hawthorne. Hawthorne's first work was a novel he published right after college called Fanshawe. He published it at his own expense and soon regretted it because he thought it was kind of amateurish. So he tried to recall all the copies so he could destroy them. He managed to make it kind of disappear from his life. Later on, we'll talk about his beloved wife, and she didn't even know that he had published it. He turned to short fiction for a while after that, and he grew into his talent and his ambition. By his late 20s, he was publishing stories like Roger Melvin's Burial and My Kinsman Major Molyneux and Young Goodman Brown, a story about witchcraft. Some say it's the best story about witchcraft ever written. He was making a little money from his writing now, which he supplemented with an administrative job at the Boston Custom House and a residency at an agricultural cooperative, and he continued to have some success and even a little fame. He published a book of his stories called Twice Told Tales when he was 32, and 5 years later, he had enough income to get married to Sophia Peabody from another prominent Salem family. She was a painter. She gave him a few paintings during their courtship, which he liked so much, he hid them behind curtains so only he could view them. They were happy together. Even ecstatic, one might say, especially in the context of Hawthorne's outlook, which is often not given to, shall we say, jubilance. Many of his writings were inspired by Sophia or referred to a period of their lives together, a particularly happy time. She was often in poor health, but she outlived Nathaniel by 7 years. Before he died, he said, quote, "She is the most sensible woman I ever knew in my life, much superior to me in general talent and of fine cultivation," end quote. Years before that, early in their marriage, Hawthorne wrote a letter to his sister in which he said, "We," meaning he and Sophia, "we are as happy as people can be without making themselves ridiculous and might be even happier. But as a matter of taste, we choose to stop short at this point." The upper crust world of Salem and Massachusetts was a small one. Many of the famous names have connections and ties to other famous people. Sophia's sister Elizabeth married the famous educational reformer Horace Mann, for example. Hawthorne went to college with the poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and with Franklin Pierce, a friend of his, who eventually became president of the United States. And in the 1840s, he and Sophia moved to Concord, Massachusetts, which was at the heart of the Transcendentalist movement. Hawthorne was something of an outsider there for reasons I suggested earlier. Their goals and their views were not fully aligned with his writings or his world outlook. Nevertheless, he met all these people, Margaret Fuller, Bronson Alcott, and his daughter Louisa May, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Henry Thoreau. While we're on the topic of friendships, let's look ahead a bit to his friendship with Herman Melville. The two are an astonishing pair. Melville, the man who went to sea, and Hawthorne, the one whose father had been taken from him by the sea. Hawthorne was older. He was 15 years older, 46 when they met. Melville was just 31. They had both achieved some literary success by then, Hawthorne for his short stories mostly, and Melville for the early novels he'd written in his 20s. Melville was a New Yorker, Hawthorne about as New England-y as it's possible to be. Melville read a new short story collection by Hawthorne and was absolutely floored. Quote, "A man of a deep and noble nature has seized me in this seclusion. His wild witch voice rings through me," end quote. He also said he fell under his spell. Of course, one wonders if Hawthorne, who changed his last name to distance himself from Hanging Judge Hawthorne, would have loved the witch voice reference and reference to a spell, but how could he really object? Melville was so captivated by the stories, and this was before the Scarlet Letter became famous, after it was published, but before it really became famous, Melville compared Hawthorne with Shakespeare. "I am posterity speaking by proxy," he wrote, "when I declare that the American who up to the present day has evinced in literature the largest brain with the largest heart, that man is Nathaniel Hawthorne." End quote. They wrote each other letters for a while. They met in person and went on a hike. Hawthorne liked Melville enough to invite him to stay for a few days. Melville was out of his mind with joy. He bought a house 6 miles away from Hawthorne's. They met often, and Melville said they were, quote, "discussing the universe with a bottle of brandy and cigars," end quote. Hawthorne wrote in his diary that they stayed up late talking about time and eternity, things of this world and of the next, and books and publishers and all possible and impossible matters. Hawthorne had just published The Scarlet Letter, and Melville wrote and published Moby Dick, his masterpiece, just a year later after they met. He dedicated the book to Hawthorne, writing, quote, "In token of my admiration for his genius, this book is inscribed to Nathaniel Hawthorne," end quote. He misspelled Hawthorne's first name in his inscription, but never mind that. What matters more to us is that the two were in sync for this period. They both had this amazing dark energy, Hawthorne with his focus on sin and guilt, and Melville with his obsession with obsession. Moby Dick got hammered in reviews, some of them, and Hawthorne stood up for the book. But he seems to have grown tired of Melville, whose passion for their friendship came on a little strong. It was a little much. Hawthorne wrote to Melville and said, "Ignore the critics of Moby Dick. This is your best work yet." And Melville was so inspired by the letter, in such a fever of gratitude, he wrote back, "Your heart beat in my ribs and mine in yours, and both in God's. It is a strange feeling. No hopefulness is in it, and no despair. Content, that is it, and irresponsibility, but without licentious inclination. I speak now of my profoundest sense of being, not of an incidental feeling. Whence come you, Hawthorne? By what right do you drink from my flagon of life? And when I put it to my lips, lo, they are yours and not mine. I feel that the Godhead is broken up like the bread at the supper, and that we are the pieces." I found some of these quotes from brainpickings.org, by the way, one of my favorite websites, highly recommended. They had an article on this friendship. Melville added to his letter this beauty, quote, "I can't stop yet. If the world was entirely made up of magicians, I'll tell you what I should do. I should have a paper mill established at one end of the house, and so have an endless riband of foolscap rolling in upon my desk, and upon that endless riband I should write 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, is in you and my magnet responds. Which is the biggest? A foolish question. They are one. End quote. And so that was kind of it for Hawthorne. He started pulling away. Melville wrote, "It is that blackness in Hawthorne that so fixes and fascinates me. It may be, nevertheless, that it is too largely developed in him. Perhaps he does not give us a ray of his light for every shade of his dark." They were never close again. The whole thing lasted for 15 months. From 1850 to 1852, the friendship haunted Melville. He viewed Hawthorne as kind of a spiritual god, a muse, his superior, an intellect he admired, someone he needed to know. He might have been in love with him, physically, mentally. We're not sure exactly, but here's what we got. The Scarlet Letter, which came just before, and then Moby Dick. And also The House of the Seven Gables, Pierre, and the Blithedale Romance in just 2 years. And then they were done. They only saw each other two more times after that. Both got jobs in custom houses in the future, different custom houses. Hawthorne's in Salem and Melville's in New York. They had a kind of writerly and spiritual connection for the rest of their lives. But Hawthorne was just not as ecstatic. And he seems to have been a little weary of Melville. Maybe it was his youth, maybe his enthusiasm, maybe it was the exuberance for being together, which almost grew manic. Here's what Hawthorne said of one of their final visits. Quote, "Melville, as he always does, began to reason of providence and futurity and of everything that lies beyond human ken, and informed me that he had pretty much made up his mind to be annihilated. But still he does not seem to rest in that anticipation, and I think will never rest until he gets hold of a definite belief. It is strange how he persists and has persisted ever since I knew him, and probably long before, in wandering to and fro over these deserts, as dismal and monotonous as the sand hills amid which we were sitting. He can neither believe nor be comfortable in his unbelief, and he is too honest and courageous not to try to do one or the other. If he were a religious man, he would be one of the most truly religious and reverential. He has a very high and noble nature, and better worth immortality than most of us." Poor Melville didn't get the relationship that he wanted, or the friendship. Hawthorne was very fair, though. He was very shrewd in his assessment of Melville, very generous. Melville didn't get what he wanted, but the rest of us got what might be the two greatest novels written in the United States. It's like a fast fireworks display or a fever dream, those 2 years, that still has the power to make us tremble and shiver. Okay, returning to our narrative. After Hawthorne left Concord, he returned to Salem to get a job in the Custom House, which he had to pull some strings to get. He was politically connected, in which he describes that position, that job that he took, he describes in the preface to The Scarlet Letter, famously. We'll have a little more on that in our follow-up episode with The Scarlet Letter. We're now up to the point in our story where we can turn to our tweet of the week. So let's take a quick break and come back. This tweet will feed right into our discussion of Hawthorne and how he viewed his work. Our tweet of the week comes from actress Kristen Johnston, responding to Lawrence Hakiwai, a self-described radio news old-timer who wrote a review of Bridgerton, which is a new Netflix show. As a little background for you, Bridgerton is a very popular series that just launched. It's by Shonda Rhimes, and it's a bingeable series set in Regency-era England, which is the early 19th century, but with a modern sensibility. It's been described as Jane Austen meets Scandal, meets Gossip Girl, meets The Favorite. Shonda Rhimes is a crowd pleaser, and that's what this is, and that's what this does. And there are black characters. They're just there. They're not specifically identified as being black. Prejudice in this world is not driven by race, but by wealth and class status. Lawrence Hakiwai objected. He said in his tweet, quote, "Bridgerton is very hard to watch. All the pre-launch hype was about the sex scenes, but that ignores the elephant in the room. Pretending upper-class England in the Regency was full of wealthy black people is ridiculous." End quote. And Kristen Johnston, who's not in the show, but who watched it and liked it, replied, quote, "I was on a show about aliens living in Ohio. Dumbass," end quote. Okay. The last sentence was targeted a little direct, probably unnecessary. That didn't make it the tweet of the week, dumbass, although it made me laugh. Her first sentence was enough to win her the History of Literature podcast tweet of the week. I probably should have played that before I read the tweet. Anyway, congratulations, Kristen Johnston, for earning yourself the tweet of the week. Why was this the tweet of the week? Because it fits right in with our discussion of Hawthorne today. Hawthorne drew a distinction between romances and novels. And by romances, he wasn't talking about romance novels in the way we discussed a month or two ago when we looked at Danielle Steele and Jenny Kruse in The Notebook and that genre of novels. Hawthorne's title for The Scarlet Letter was The Scarlet Letter, A Romance. Later in life, he wrote The Blithedale Romance and Septimus, A Romance, and The Marble Faun, or The Romance of Monte Beni. He wrote Dr. Grimshaw's Secret, A Romance. He later published The Dolliver Romance and Kindred Tales. Here we are talking about one of the greatest novelists in American literature. The esteemed critic Harold Bloom ranks Hawthorne with Faulkner and Henry James as one of the three greatest American novelists. And yet, Hawthorne is not calling his novels novels. He's calling them romances. What is going on here? Well, he himself tells us the difference between a romance and a novel in his view in his preface to The House of the Seven Gables, which came out 1 year after The Scarlet Letter. He says, quote, "When a writer calls his work a romance, it need hardly be observed that he wishes to claim a certain latitude, both as to its fashion and material, which he would not have felt himself entitled to assume had he professed to be writing a novel. The latter form of composition is presumed to aim at a very minute fidelity, not merely to the possible, but to the probable and ordinary course of man's experience. The former, while as a work of art, it must rigidly subject itself to laws, and while it sins unpardonably so far as it may swerve aside from the truth of the human heart, has fairly a right to present that truth under circumstances, to a great extent, of the writer's own choosing or creation. If he think fit, also, he may so manage his atmospherical medium as to bring out or mellow the lights and deepen and enrich the shadows of the picture. He will be wise, no doubt, to make a very moderate use of the privileges here stated, and especially to mingle the marvelous rather as a slight, delicate, and evanescent flavor than as any portion of the actual substance of the dish offered to the public. He can hardly be said, however, to commit a literary crime, even if he disregard this caution." End quote. So there we have it, a mid-19th century look at writers, their use of history, their use of factual detail, and the distinction between romances and novels. It's a distinction we've pretty much lost today. Back then, the novel was the king of the 19th century. It was the literary form to read, and you had people like Walter Scott and Alexander Dumas dipping into history for their subjects. You also had writers like Balzac and Dickens cataloging the world of the present. And today, we would lump all of that together and call it fiction, and we would call all of those long pieces of fiction novels. But for Hawthorne, the distinction between a novel and a romance was meaningful. A novel, he says, has to be faithful not just to the possible, but to the probable and the ordinary course of events. A romance deals with the truth of the human heart. But writers in a romance are free to create the circumstances and manage the atmosphere, turn the lights up or down, enrich and deepen the shadows. He says, don't get carried away, authors. But even if the authors do get carried away, that's fine too. It's a romance. After all, invention is to be expected. Author imagination is one of the tools in the authorial toolbox, and it's okay to dabble in the supernatural or the ahistorical as long as you're presenting the truth about the human condition. That's where the tweet of the week comes in. Pretending upper-class England in the Regency was full of wealthy black people is ridiculous, says tweeter Lawrence. And Kristen says, it's a television show. Space aliens in Ohio are also ridiculous. People bursting into song is ridiculous, by the way, but that doesn't mean we can't watch West Side Story or La Boheme. Zombies are ridiculous. Animals that talk are ridiculous, but we're not talking about a documentary here. You're applying the wrong framework to your viewing experience, Lawrence. You should watch thinking, what are these characters doing? What do they want? What are they afraid of? What does this have? What impact does this have on me? Not this person as a type wouldn't exist at this time. It's not a documentary. Imagine your way into it and look for the truths of the human heart. Hawthorne used history in this way. During those 12 years he spent writing, his apprentice years trying to become a writer, he also read a lot, including about the Puritans and his ancestors. This was when he changed his name, when he added the W. And he wasn't a historian of the Puritans when he started writing. He imagined his way into their world. He put characters into those scenarios, and he thought about what their judgment and their guilt and their views of themselves said or could possibly say about our world, about human beings universally. You don't read Hawthorne to learn actual historical details about the Puritans and their community and their lives. You read Hawthorne to follow him down a different path, where he says, look at this group, look at these people, what they believed and what they did based on those beliefs, how they organized their lives around those beliefs. Imagine what it meant for these people. How much pain it caused, how much fear and terror, how they absorbed all that and fostered it and promoted it. What made them all do it? And what in us would do the same? Why wouldn't the same thing happen today if it wouldn't? We are going to have an entire episode devoted just to the Scarlet Letter, so I'll turn instead to his other works to give you a sense of what animated Hawthorne. If you're keeping track, we're somewhere between number 7 and number 8 on our list now, for those of you following along. Critic Nina Baim says, quote, "The atmosphere, setting, and action in Hawthorne's works are always a unique blending of the familiar and the strange, the logical and the dreamlike, the humdrum and the marvelous, or, in Hawthorne's words, the actual and the imaginary. He prefers settings far from his own time and place." The Puritans, remember, had flourished 2 centuries before his own era, where he can begin with sparse historical outlines and fill the scene with his own images and metaphors of the inner world. End quote. Young Goodman Brown is a story about a man living in the village of Salem who leaves his wife one day at twilight to go off on an unknown errand in the forest. She begs him not to go. He meets an older man who carries a black staff shaped like a serpent. Other townspeople are in the woods too, including his wife, who's named Faith, and who had previously urged him not to go. They're all traveling in the same direction. And he stumbles into a clearing, and the townspeople are there. They're all there. It's midnight, and they're carrying out a secret ceremony with a flaming altar. Goodman Brown and his wife are the only two who aren't initiated into the society. He calls to heaven for assistance, and the scene suddenly vanishes. He wakes up the next morning, unsure if he dreamed what had happened the night before. His belief that he lives in a Christian community is shaken. From that point forward, his life is one of deep cynicism and suspicion, and it ends with this: "And when he had lived long and was borne to his grave, they carved no hopeful verse upon his tombstone, for his dying hour was gloom." Stephen King based a story on this called The Man in the Black Suit, which won the O. Henry Prize. King said, "The story, Young Goodman Brown, is one of the 10 best stories ever written in America." Melville loved it, calling it as deep as Dante. Henry James said it was a magnificent little romance. There again, we see the distinction between novels and romances. Romance fiction can be short too, a romance. Where do we go with this story? What do we make of it? Well, we're in Salem. We all know the connection with witches here and witchcraft, and the names Goodman Brown and Faith are the names of the Puritans. That was the kind of thing they named themselves. Hawthorne is imagining himself back into the world of the Puritans and saying, look at what this is like. Let me back up a little bit. When you look at religion today and you see, let's say, a televangelist and he's calling for money so he can buy himself a jet plane, you think I'm exaggerating? I'm not. I'm not just saying a televangelist who flies in a private plane or charters a plane here and there, but one who says, I need money to buy myself a private plane. God wants me to have it, and he wants you to give me the money so I can buy it. Here's a news report from 2018.
You know, I've owned three different jets in my life, and used them and just burning them up for the Lord Jesus Christ.
Televangelist Jesse Duplantis says God himself told him it's time for an upgrade.
He said, I want you to believe me for a Falcon 7X. So I said, okay.
A Falcon 7 jet like this one to preach to more people around the world. And he's asking his followers for the $54 million.
I really believe that if Jesus was physically on the earth today, he wouldn't be riding a donkey.
From his Louisiana headquarters, Duplantis is among a group of televangelists who preach that their wealth is God's will.
This preys upon the poorest people that want and need money badly, where they're told if they give money, God's going to bless them 100-fold.
Duplantis lives in a 35,000-square-foot mansion, tax-free.
He's asking everybody who has less than he has to pay for this jet, and I don't get that, you know?
Fellow televangelist Kenneth Copeland recently bought a $36 million Gulfstream 5 jet.
Praise God. Isn't that good?
The two have commiserated about how they can't fly or pray with commercial airline passengers.
This dope-filled world, right. And get in a long tube with a bunch of demons.
Right, that's exactly the
point. And it's deadly.
We asked Jesse Duplantis and his ministries for...
Okay. Everyone is free to do what they want and to think what they want and believe what they want. But how does that fit into Christianity? Do you read the New Testament and think, oh yeah, Jesus would definitely want the people to pay for luxury items. The poorest of the poor should be buying a private plane for the powerful and the wealthy. That's not how I read it. When people go into the church and they buy into this and then they come out and cause trouble and they do it all in God's name, you have to wonder, what happened to the Sermon on the Mount? Where are the blessed meek in all of this? And Hawthorne looks at this Puritan society, including his own ancestors, and he says, okay, fine. They were persecuted for their beliefs, and they probably had a good point when they came to America. Fleeing persecution. They were Christian and they hated the corruption of the church, the ostentation and the wealth. But then what happened? They came to America. They started this colony, setting aside the removal of the people who were there before them, the indigenous people. Even looking at just the colonists themselves and their religious beliefs and the society that they were trying to set up for themselves based in spirituality and Christianity, and then they flogged Quakers in the streets and hanged women for witchcraft. What would it be like to be a thoughtful person in those days if you sat in church listening to the Bible, maybe read it for yourself, and then went outside and saw these same people, the ministers, the leaders, the most pious individuals out there with a whip and a noose committing these atrocities? Wouldn't it drive you mad? Wouldn't you wonder where the world had gone wrong? In another of Hawthorne's stories, also set in Puritan New England, a minister shows up one day wearing a black veil. You can't see the top of his face, just his mouth and chin. He takes the pulpit, and nobody knows why he's chosen to wear the veil that day, and he doesn't say why. His sermon that day is about secret sin, which leads people to reflect on their own secrets, their own guilt, and to wonder why exactly he's talking about it. Wherever he goes, gloom arrives with him. It's as if he's haunting the community with knowledge about the darkness within them all. His fiancée tries to get him to explain. She jokes about it, but he won't take it off, and he won't explain why he's wearing it. Eventually, she leaves him. Now, we know there was some precedence for this. Some inspiration from real life. There was a clergyman in Maine who was called Handkerchief Moody, because he accidentally killed a friend of his, and he wore a black veil from the day of the man's funeral until he himself died. Handkerchief Moody may have been the ancestor of author Rick Moody, author of Garden State and The Ice Storm, who wrote a memoir called The Black Veil, digging into his past. Like I said, New England is a small world sometimes. But getting back to Hawthorne and his short story, we don't know why the minister wears the veil. What we do know is that he becomes a kind of totem for the community. People are drawn to him. He converts people. Dying sinners want to see him and only him. They see themselves in him. And again, what's so great about this is that it's concentrated but expansive. It's concentrated, by that I mean it's like an allegory. Although, I'm kind of with Poe, who liked Hawthorne but didn't like allegory necessarily. Hawthorne is a great one for allegory. I kind of don't like allegory because of the way people talk about literature. I hate it when literature is treated like a game or a puzzle, and they say, oh, well, this is an allegory for that, so I figured it out. No. Or no, it's not. It's an allegory for something else, and then you stop there. Okay, the white whale is an allegory for X. Who cares? That's like saying an oligarchy is a system of government in which a small group of people hold power and exert control. Okay, great. You know the definition. Fine. That's a start. But what does that mean? What does it mean to live in an oligarchy? Who wants to be an oligarch? Do we all? Is this something we all secretly aspire to be in charge? What in us is drawn to the idea of living in an oligarchy? Do we admire powerful families that much that we want to bend our knee to them? Do we worship aristocrats or religious leaders or smart people or the wealthy? Do we think oligarchies are efficient? Do oligarchs go bad always? Where does this world take us? Do oligarchs abuse their power? Do they make us feel bad about ourselves? How do they exert this control? Through force? Do we feel like we don't have enough say in an oligarchy? Is that why we need democracy? Because it's a pressure valve that can be released? All these questions are the kinds of things I want to know. I don't want to just know the definition of oligarchy. In allegory, I don't want to just know, the black veil stands for X, secret sin or guilt, whatever you want. But the people in the story are much more interesting than that sentence. A man who thinks he needs to wear this thing, why? What takes him to that point? Is it God? Belief in God, his reading of the Bible, some awful crime in his past that he's trying to expunge with this veil? Is it like those self-flagellating religious zealots? Is it adultery? Does he just think he was born that way in sin? And why does the community trust him more because of it? Do they see themselves in him? Do they think that they too should be wearing a black veil? And look what else happens. He has a fiance. She's happy. She's content. She's life-affirming. And he acts like all that is bad, not for him, poisonous, that he's unworthy of it. God has put her on earth to laugh and be full of life, and what does he do? He says it's bad. He refuses to participate. Isn't that a greater crime? Isn't that worse? Turning your back on the beauty of creation? Why? So you can live a haunted life, bringing dour gloom to everyone around you? And now we're in the world of Puritans, aren't we? Do you wear gray and never wear an adornment and shun all signs of beauty and individuality and condemn others who are different or who stray and say that babies are sinful from the moment they're born? Is that really what we want from life? Is that what God wants us to do? We get one chance at this world. Does God want us to spend it afraid of our own shadow, never letting anyone commit a mistake and flogging Quakers in the streets because they have a slightly different view of Christianity? Are we so convinced of our sin that we forget how to live? Do we tie ourselves in such knots trying to be perfect that we end up destroying the best parts of ourselves? Where is the room for inner turmoil in all of this? And then, making the great leap forward, 150 years to Hawthorne, he says, look at what we have here in the 1840s and 50s. Look at this bedrock. This is our country, the United States. This is what we have. We just started a few decades ago. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, was the president when I was born, says Hawthorne. It's tempting to start the narrative of this nation with that, with some high-minded ideals, some first principles, a new system of government. It's tempting to start with the Revolutionary War and maybe the Constitution, the founding documents, and say, wow, here's a nation. But we go back so much farther. We're not just the United States. We're America. We go back farther in time, and we expand beyond the borders of these little states that we've cobbled together. We go back to those Puritans arriving on boats. And look at what the foundation of that is. Look at their guilt, their religious devotion, and the twists and turns that took. Look at how they treated one another in the name of Christianity. Look at how they treated the people who were here first. Look at how they then treated one another. Look at how central the concepts of sin and blame and God and demons were to those people. They struggled with so much inner torment, and their community was built on these incredible, strong passions. Look at where men are in this world, and women, and churchgoers, and sinners, the shunners and the shunned, and look at what the rest of us have inherited 100 or so years later, says Hawthorne, and now we can add another 150 years or so. And as we try to understand ourselves, look at the deeply embedded concepts that are as part of us as the separation of powers and all men are created equal and liberty and free speech and freedom of religion. We have those things. They're in our founding documents. We have a democracy, but we have demons too. And sometimes we might think those demons are apparitions who appear to us in a clearing in the dark forest at night. And sometimes those dark forests are in our minds, and the demons dwell there too. Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature podcast. We are going to tackle the Scarlet Letter next episode, or soon anyway. I'm going to read a bit from the Custom House and a bit from the beginning of the novel, or should I say romance. Now you know why I'm saying that. And we'll talk about what makes that book so great and what makes it so compelling. Happy New Year, everyone. We are the History of Literature podcast. What a strange thing to say. I didn't mean to say that. We are teamed up with LitHub Radio. That's what I wanted to say. And the Podglomerate, which you can find more about at... Find out more about them at www.thepodglomerate.com. You can find us on Twitter at TheJackWilson. That's J-A-C-K-E Wilson. Or at Mike's handle at LiteratureSC. If you'd like to help us out, it's patreon.com/literature or historyofliterature.com/shop. Another place to donate. You can buy virtual coffees there in $5 increments. If you liked the show and you like the idea of splitting a coffee with me, maybe treating me to a coffee, you can do so at historyofliterature.com/shop. All donations and support are much appreciated. I think that's it. Tweet of the week, a listener email, and Hawthorne. Hawthorne and more Hawthorne, and yet we just scratched the surface with this guy. Well, what you can do. What you can do. What can you do? We could return to this later. That leaves room for you to go exploring. Hawthorne's worth the trip. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Podglomerate, a Sonic Universe.